non-resident hire is part of what allows the Alaska economy to grow, which in turn generates greater opportunities for residents.
State lawmakers examine the impacts of non-resident employees on the state's economy. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a mining prospect on Prince of Wales Island for rare earth minerals.
Over the past 80 years, I don't think I've ever seen or read about any kind of hype that we're witnessing in the rare earths.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
A little communication can save a life. Take time to connect with the ones you love and show them you care. This is National Suicide Prevention Week. Know the signs and take them seriously. For help and information, visit carelinealaska.com or call the 24-hour hotline 1-877-266-HELP. This message is sponsored by the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
State legislators today began looking at the discrepancy between Department of Labor reports of high employment on the North Slope and high unemployment among Alaskans qualified to work there. Kara Moriarty, the deputy director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, an industry support group, presented the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee with an early release of a study done by the McDowell Group, indicating there had been little change in the ratio between resident and non-resident employees. She said the study shows that jobs usually rise and fall together. However, she pointed to numbers indicating that a large portion of the state's economy relies on non-resident employees.
Statewide, 22% of the private workforce was defined as non-resident in 2009. Sectors with higher non-resident participation include seafood processing, scenic and sightseeing transportation, accommodations, and metal mining. Non-resident hire is part of what allows the Alaska economy to grow, which in turn generates greater opportunities for residents.
The McDowell Group that prepared the association study is now working on a more detailed study of the North Slope workforce for the Senate Finance Committee. Fairbanks Senator Joe Thomas cited the classification of a resident as a person who qualifies for a permanent fund dividend. He said that allows a non-resident to accept a job in Alaska and in future years to be qualified as a resident.
It seems to me that's the crux of the problem, is what are we not doing to create the skill set that would allow a resident to be hired, rather than, because theoretically if you carried that out, we could at some point in time have basically 100% of the people working on the North Slope, let's say, that were at one time non-residents, and none of them prior to actually receiving their job had been an Alaska resident.
The committee will hear from the public tonight in Fairbanks and will hold another set of hearings in Anchorage on Thursday. Governor Parnell has used low employment as a reason for promoting tax cuts to the oil industry. That issue will be back before the legislature in next year's session. Parnell this afternoon sent an email message to his supporters reminding them of his position on the issue and asked them to participate in the committee hearings. With rare earth prices skyrocketing, a Canadian company has rolled out an aggressive schedule to begin mining the coveted minerals on Prince of Wales Island within 4 years. Deanna Garrison of member station KRBD recently visited the UCOR site and has the story.
Based in Halifax, Nova Scotia, UCOR Rare Earth Metals Incorporated is spending a projected $8 million this summer exploring the deposit at Bokan. The company is hoping to drum up investor interest in the project, which by all accounts appears to be one of the most promising deposits of heavy rare earths in the U.S., if not the world. Visitors are brought to the company's floating camp in Kendrick Bay, where some 22 crew members eat and sleep during their stints at the secluded mine. UCOR Vice President of Exploration Harmon Kaiser greets us with mineral samples collected since the company began exploration at Bokan in 2007.
We're looking at a piece of rare earth mineralization from Bokan Mountain, and it consists of a variety of a complex of rare earth minerals and accessory minerals, including chlorite, magnetite, fluorite, albite, and quartz.
Inside the floating camp, UCOR CEO Jim McKenzie explains to the group that rare earth metals, especially heavy rare earths, are, well, rare.
Certainly, in terms of relativity, Bokan's it for the United States.
McKenzie describes heavy rare earths as steroids for other minerals. He says they are used widely in the high-tech, clean energy, and multiple other industries.
Heavy rare earths are used extensively in the aviation industry. They're used a great deal in military applications. The U.S. Department of Defense is very dependent on heavy rare earths for radar and sonar and for remote missiles and smart weapons and the whole gamut. You can't have high-tech military applications today without heavy rare earths. And then it goes well beyond that, obviously. They're absolutely indispensable to the automotive industry. Light and heavy rare earths are used in batteries for electric vehicles.
Ucore originally acquired the Bokan site in 2006 in hopes of reviving the property's uranium mine. At the time, McKenzie says a company was aware of a 1989 U.S. Geological Survey report estimating a high concentrate of rare earths at Bokan, but rare earth prices were low. Soon thereafter, uranium prices tanked. The value of heavy rare earth minerals then shot through the roof when China, which produces 97% of the world's heavy rare earths, announced it was scaling back its heavy rare earth exports.
The U.S. is the world's largest consumer of end product, and China is the world's largest monopolistic producer of the product. They produce essentially 100% of the rare earths that are consumed in the world right now, and due to their most recent five-year plan, they are withdrawing the product from international arenas, and that has triggered the tech metals crisis and a term that I love, rare earth mania.
Probably an understatement.
That's what Dan Cordier, a rare earth commodity specialist with the U.S. Geological Survey, thinks of the term rare earth mania.
Rare earth is probably one of the hottest commodities for sure in my lifetime and probably over the past 80 years. I don't think I've ever seen or read about any kind of hype that we're witnessing in the rare earths.
For instance, dysprosium, one of the heavy rare earths at Bokan, has quadrupled in price since April. Hoping to capitalize on the meteoric rise in prices, Ucore wants to permit and build the mine at Bokan in 4 years.
By 2013, we're hoping to be in a position where we can break ground and start building our mine, have the mine constructed by 2015, so in 4 years. And it's a doable scenario, and that's what we're shooting for. Certainly, if it wasn't for permitting, we could have the mine constructed a great deal quicker than that. Obviously, we're in the civilized world, and you have to go through permitting and so forth. So the good news is that it looks like both the Alaskan government and the federal government are behind us to expedite permitting and have this happen as quickly as possible.
Cordier says Ucore's timeline is extremely ambitious.
It'll take quite a bit of research and development to bring that mine into production. Normally it takes anywhere from 7 to 15 years for a mine to come online.
To date, the company has drilled 143 holes at Bokan. So far, Ucore has identified a deposit of 60 million pounds of total rare earth oxides at Bokan. The company expects to mine 500 to 800 tons a day. Based on Ucore's current exploration estimates, the company says a mine would operate for 20 to 30 years. However, if the company finds as much mineralization as it expects, the mine life could extend to 60 years or beyond. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
The lava dome at a remote Alaska volcano has resumed growing, prompting officials to raise its alert level. The dome now fills the floor of the crater at Cleveland Volcano, 940 miles southwest of Anchorage. The Alaska Volcano Observatory today raised the volcano's alert status to watch. The dome is now about 394 feet in diameter. Officials say if that continues, lava flows could start on the flanks of the volcano. The growing dome also increases the possibility, but doesn't ensure, an explosive eruption. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new school for children with autism.
I think we are successful because we have taught him many things that we were told when he was young he would never learn.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
The U.S. Postal Service warned Congress today it could lose $10 billion in the fiscal year that ends this month. That puts the Postal Service in danger of defaulting as it reaches its borrowing limit. The Postmaster General, Patrick Donahoe, is asking Congress to let it break union contracts to fire employees, change retirees' health benefits, and end mail delivery on Saturdays. He testified before the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, where Alaska Senator Mark Begich questioned the plan to cut Saturday service.
We're concerned about this from a variety of reasons, the rural component, but also, as a small business person, what it will impact a small business owner who really depends on as much delivery time as possible. They're not corporate. They don't have mail runners to go package up their stuff and ship it over to the post office. The owner has to do it, and they have to go do it. And small businesses depend on delivery as well as making sure that they get their mail coming in for supplies and so forth. How do you respond to that?
Begich says he's especially concerned about very small businesses, those with 15 employees and fewer. Postmaster General Donahoe says of all the possible places to cut, Saturday service makes the most sense.
Generally, the volume is about 10-15% lower on Saturday than the rest of the week. We will keep post offices open on Saturday, so people would have access to our 30,000-plus post offices.
For shipping packages and so forth for the small business.
Right. We'd be able to provide that service. Now, we will not be running what we call outgoing mail that night, so that mail would go out on Monday. But they would have the access to our services.
Senator Begich's office said after today's hearing that he remains concerned about the impacts of cuts on rural Alaska. Thousands of post offices throughout the country are being studied for closure. But Alaskans got the news last month that 25 of 36 post offices being considered for shuttering here are safe for now. 11 Alaskan post offices are still being eyed for closure. Exactly which ones are being spared remains to be seen. Release of the list was delayed because postal officials said they had to focus on problems in the wake of Hurricane Irene on the East Coast. But that was more than a week ago, and the Alaska Congressional delegation hopes to receive the list soon. About 480 Anchorage School District students are currently certified as autistic or having Asperger's syndrome. Most take the programs offered within the district. But next year, a few parents could choose a new alternative. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Suzanne Letso, CEO of the Connecticut Center of Child Development, had just finished overseeing a recent two-day conference on autism sponsored by the center. But Letso explains the conference was not the sole reason for her latest trip to Anchorage.
We've been working intermittently here on a consulting basis for families and have been asked for a number of years to start a private school-based program here. And we recently did a reassessment of our internal capacity and decided that we were ready to take on that challenge.
The nonprofit Connecticut Center of Child Development currently has two school sites in that state with a double mission. First, they use an intensive applied behavior analysis approach on a one-to-one basis on students with autism, Asperger's syndrome, or other developmental disorders. The second function is to train individuals seeking national certification in behavior analysis. Letso says both services would take place at the proposed Anchorage School.
Our target date for the school to open is sometime between March 1st and March 15th, 2012. A lot of that will be driven by what location we find and how quickly we can complete renovations.
Letso brought several of her staff here to Anchorage for the Autism Conference. She says there's no shortage of members willing to transfer to Alaska.
The plans for the school are that we're going to be sending several of our Connecticut-based employees to live in Alaska, and then Judy Palazzo, who is our clinical director, will be supporting them as well daily via distance, but she'll also be here for big chunks of time. But the rest of the staff we plan to hire from the local population here and hopefully get them trained up and able to take over and run the school and start their own programs as well.
The school will start small, initially accepting up to 8 students between 2 and 22 years old. It will grow as the needed qualified staff become available for the center's intensive approach. Anchorage School District Superintendent Carol Como said early intervention with autistic children was extremely important. She saw the new school as augmenting the district's program, which begins with 3-year-olds.
I'm certainly going to want, as a district, cooperate with folks as they're building this, because certainly there are students, they may start there, come to us, or they may start with us and go to them. So we definitely need a collaborative working relationship with this group of people.
The state's per-student funding and additional support money for students with disabilities would transfer from the district to the new school to cover some of the tuition. Letso notes that with autism, parents and educators must recognize success is very individual.
When we start to think, both as educators, parents, I'm a parent, it's important to me to not say that, you know, his IQ is probably about 45. He has moderate autism. He is going to have this throughout his life. I don't think we're not successful, and I don't think he's not successful because we haven't recovered him. I think we are successful because we have taught him many things that we were told when he was young he would never learn.
Letso and her husband established the Connecticut Center when they couldn't find the type of applied behavior analysis-based services they wanted for their own son. They hope that, as in Connecticut, eventually the Anchorage facility could expand to include an extended school year program, outreach for children from birth to 3 years, adult services, and a summer camp. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
A Fort Wainwright-based soldier has died of injuries suffered in an IED attack in Afghanistan. An Army statement says Specialist Christoph J. Marquez of Tampa, Florida, was guarding an entry when a vehicle carrying an improvised explosive device blew up. The incident happened August 27th in Kandahar province. Marquez died Sunday at an Army hospital in Germany. He was 40 years old. Marquez joined the Army in 2010 and arrived in Alaska last winter. He's the 11th Fort Wainwright soldier killed in Afghanistan since the 4,000-member 1st Striker Brigade deployed in April. Military officials have revised a set of proposals to expand airspace used for training exercises and lengthen the time those exercises take place in several areas around the interior. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The Alaskan Command has released a set of revisions to its original proposals, announced in January, to expand the number and types of military training exercises held on the Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex, or JPARC. The complex takes in some 66,000 square miles of land, mainly in the interior, along with some 58,000 square miles of ocean in the Gulf of Alaska. Alaskan Command leaders want to expand the JPARC to enable two or more of the armed services to conduct more realistic joint exercises. That includes expanding restricted airspace and increasing the frequency and duration of the exercises. For example, to enable the military to conduct exercises later into the night, more often throughout the year, sometimes involving explosives, such as bombs and missile warheads. Army Lieutenant Colonel Howard Hunt, one of the architects of the J-Park expansion proposals, says the revisions were made mainly to fine-tune the original plan to make it more workable and better suited to accomplish the goal of improved training. He says other changes are intended to address concerns raised by some Alaskans in public meetings held earlier this year. Some of those concerns include issues raised by pilots and hunters on airspace restrictions in military operations areas, or MOAs. Hunt says there are some misunderstandings about those restrictions, and that's one of the reasons why the revisions include the Alaskan Command's formal declaration of its intention to use measures adopted in 1997 to mitigate the airspace restrictions.
The mitigation measures that were adopted in 97 are to avoid high-density areas or sensitive noise areas such as townships and communities, or, for example, wildlife calving grounds.
Hunt says command leadership hopes the declaration will allay concerns about the impact of the J-Park expansion on Alaskan aviators and the hunters and bush communities who depend on them.
You know, the original perception was that we were shutting down a lot of airspace or land space. That's not the case. You have 24 military operational areas in the state of Alaska. What we're doing is we're requesting to expand one and add another with about the same amount of air traffic.
Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Michael Cabral, a top training exercise planner with the command, says public input was essential during the earlier meetings held around the state as part of the process of compiling the Draft Environmental Impact Statement, or Draft EIS, a document necessary for the J-Park expansion proposal to move forward.
Throughout everything that we've done to this point in time in trying to begin formulating the draft EIS, public comment has been a big part of what we've done. It drives where we focus greater efforts and the impacts. It drives us to take a closer look at the proposals.
Hunt says the public will get more chances to comment on the J-Park expansion plan early next year during a 45-day comment period that will begin after the draft EIS is released. He says the command will again hold public hearing on the document in meetings to be held in many of the same communities as the earlier round of meetings. Changes in the J-Park expansion plan can still be made if, for example, military leaders see the need for further revisions, or if members of the public express concerns or suggest alternatives that benefit both the public and the military's training objectives. A final decision on the J-Park expansion is expected in 2013. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Alaska Office of Children's Services is regionalizing its call-in process for reports of child abuse and neglect. That's prompted concerns among child welfare advocates in Petersburg, who fear it's part of an effort to shut down the local field office. The agency says that's not the case. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The Office of Children's Services has set up regional call centers for people who want to report concerns about the welfare of a child in Alaska. Those centers, like the new Southeast one in Juneau, are taking over the intake process that was formerly handled by the division's locally based social workers in 26 offices around the state. According to Southeast Regional Staff Manager Natalie Powers, the change was prompted by a federal review. It found that these initial calls were being handled differently among the various branches, and there were sometimes delays in the division's response.
The clock starts ticking when the call comes in to the agency. In small offices where you have few or one staff doing everything along the life of a case, you have people out in the field, you have people meeting with folks, you have, you know, meeting with families. They're not sitting there answering the phone, taking new calls. And so what would happen is it could take a couple days for a call to get written up and processed before it would even get looked at or screened. It could take a couple days. Well, sometimes the priority deadline could have passed by the time we even got out to it.
Powers and a colleague recently met with a small group of mental health and social work clinicians and law enforcement in Petersburg, where the division has just one staffer, a social worker who covers cases in Petersburg as well as Wrangell and Cake. Powers said with regional intake, there are staff designated to answer calls all the time and the calls are being processed more quickly. However, Powers said even under the new system, it's absolutely fine to call the local social worker first. But Police Chief Jim Agner and other Petersburg officials in the room worried the regional call center may screen out some cases that actually have a history of calls.
When we have cases that maybe don't rise to the point where they'd be screened in, that are simply screened out, when those cases continue to come in, you have a single person that can look and say, well, wait a minute, we have red flags here. And at some point in time, we have created enough issues that something needs to be done. And there's a loophole in the system that you're looking at that will let children fall through those cracks. And I see that as that's significant.
Agner asked what assurance there was that this scenario wouldn't happen with regional intake. According to OSC's Powers, the new process requires that all previous calls about a family be considered when a call comes in.
Both the supervisor and the screeners, they're forced to take a look at that history. And that is part of the overall decision. And that used to never happen before.
But Petersburg Mental Health Services Director Susan Omer thought the new system would actually serve to discourage people from calling the agency about a local child in trouble.
It seems to me that this is a way of eventually removing our support in town. That fewer calls are going to be coming in because fewer people are going to feel comfortable calling Juno. That means our stats go down. Then it's harder and harder for us to justify that we have someone in town to help us. And so that concerns me.
And that was the heart of the matter. Local officials fear OCS intends to close the Petersburg office to save money, as it did in Wrangell several years ago. Both Omer and Chief Agner accused the agency of trying to decrease the call statistics from Petersburg in order to justify such a closure.
This is a setup to where you're going to pull this office, it's happening. The stats are proving it. And I can tell you from my business, certainly Susan can tell you for her business, hey, we got no shortage of work here.
OCS Supervisor Powers said the agency is not considering closing the Petersburg office at this time, but she pointed out that OCS is responsible for all of Alaska's children, and it does have to look at caseloads around the state as it allocates resources.
I'm saying right now there is absolutely no, I have heard of no plan to move the position from Petersburg, but these are things that have to continually to be examined.
The local concern is not without precedent. Back in 2009, there were two OCS positions in Petersburg, and the agency considered moving both of them to Juneau. After an outcry from the community and intervention by State Representative Peggy Wilson of Wrangell, OCS ultimately kept one of the social worker jobs in Petersburg. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Lynn Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. Do you know a nonprofit executive or tribal leader who is at risk for job burnout? Nominate them for a Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical, which provides paid time away for personal renewal and growth. Go to Rasmussen.org for more information, but don't wait. Nominees must complete an application by October 1st. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.